This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
With apologies to management guru Peter Drucker, this line of his came to mind the other day. You can't manage, Drucker said, what you can't measure. Exhibit A during this shutdown? Oh, the American economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 7th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let us begin, shall we, with what we are not going to learn about the American economy this week. Today, we ought to be able to tell you how strong or not strong American factory orders were in the month of November, but we can't because the Commerce Department didn't release that data this morning on account of the shutdown. Likewise, tomorrow, we are not going to be able to tell you what the trade war with China did to the trade deficit in November, also thanks to the shutdown. Sidebar spoiler alert here, by the way. The trade deficit almost certainly got bigger, close parentheses. But on the economic plus side, tomorrow we are going to get data on job openings and consumer credit. That will come from federal agencies that aren't shut down. Also, we will get a good barometer of how small businesses are feeling. That'll come from the National Federation of Independent Business, which isn't part of the government at all. All of which is to say, we are starting kind of, sort of, maybe to get to the point where what we know about the $19 trillion behemoth that is the American economy is becoming patchy and incomplete. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what that might mean as the shutdown drags on.
So we didn't get those factory order numbers from the Commerce Department this morning, and the clues we have from other economic reports are sending mixed signals. Job growth is running strong, but orders are weakening. Here's Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial.
For manufacturing, things are actually still pretty good. Looking forward, the expectations are less positive.
McMillan says right now he's not too worried that some government economic reports aren't being released, though he says if the shutdown lasts a month or more, that could start to unsettle investors. Bill Dunkelberg at the National Federation of Independent Business says for small companies, economic data points matter less than what's happening locally.
So they're really responding to what's coming in the front door, the orders coming in, people coming in.
But businesses with national and international reach will be hampered by the lack of up-to-date economic data from the government. That's according to Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
This is information that is absolutely essential for business leaders, for investors, and even the Federal Reserve to get a better understanding of what current economic conditions are like.
Baumol says the economy appears to be at an inflection point right now between very strong growth and a slowdown.
Even if we had all the usual economic data, there is no doubt 2019 is expected to be a consequential year for the economy. So we're kind of operating a little bit in the darkness here.
He says one shutdown effect we're likely to see in data the government is continuing to release is lost income, as hundreds of thousands of government workers go without paychecks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was this small bit of good shutdown news today. Actually, it's not small at all. The Office of Management and Budget says the IRS is going to pay tax refunds after all, even if the shutdown does drag into filing season. So there is that spot of bright news about the shutdown. Brian Duncan is a friend of the program. He's a family farmer in Illinois. He does hogs mostly. He's also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. We talked to him from time to time, most recently about trade and the tariffs. But we got to thinking at our meeting this morning, he would probably have something to say about the shutdown as well. So we called him back up. Mr. Duncan, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Nice to visit with you again, Kai.
So as I said, there are a couple of things we want to talk to you about. First of all, the shutdown. Is that affecting you at all in terms of being able to get market prices for the hogs or any of that sort of data stuff?
Right now, we're still getting data. You know, we're pretty early in the shutdown. As this goes on, I'm sure we will see more pronounced impacts. But right now, we're doing okay.
What kind of data would you be depending on? What does the government have? What does the USDA have that you want?
Well, sure. Coming up on January 11th is a major supply-demand report, which projects prices for the upcoming year, usages, things like that on a national and global level. So that's data that's important to us as we plan for next year, or actually now this year's crops. Hmm. In other shutdowns, we've lost access to that data, but so far we are getting that. Hmm. As we go on, supply-demand report will be one that we'll miss in going forward.
What about the federal aid that the Trump administration put on to help some of the farmers and folks like yourself who are being hurt by the tariffs? Those payments, it's my understanding, have stopped, right?
Sure, they have. A lot of farmers, myself included, went in and were able to sign up last year prior to the shutdown. I still have not signed up for the corn aid. We didn't finish harvest until New Year's Eve day.
Ooh.
On corn. Yeah,
happy
rotten
New
weather here. But
huh.
And I know I've spoken with some farmers who would like to go in here and apply now prior to the January 15th deadline, but obviously because our offices are closed, are unable to do so.
Well, look, this is actually really, really interesting because as I talk to you, it occurs to me that you've got a bunch of time-sensitive things that are dependent not on man, but on nature, right? You got to plant, you got to get the sows in to breed them or whatever you do with hogs. And it's not like that stuff waits.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, this is the winter here. We're 3 or 4 months away from planting season. So there's not the sense of urgency out here that if we were having this discussion in 3 months, my tone would be a lot different.
Fair enough. Let me take a very quick turn to trade and the tariffs. As you know, better than most probably who are listening, the Chinese government put tariffs on American hogs and the Farm Belt has been hit by those tariffs. There are negotiations now happening in Beijing. You taking any hope? You taking any solace from that?
We are keeping a very close eye, especially what's going on in China this week. And hopeful to see some resolution, some steps taken on both sides to resolve these ongoing disputes.
One hates to pry here, Mr. Duncan, but between the shutdown and the trade stuff and the tariffs and the USMCA and China and Mexico and all of that, how long until this really starts to bite you in the shorts?
Oh, it already has.
Huh.
Agriculture's taken a huge hit, and you just don't have to take my word for it. Iowa State economists talking about the pork industry in general, losses in excess of $2 billion on an industry between China and Mexico. I mean, we are on the front lines of this war and paying some pretty high economic costs. Huh. The Farm Belt's already gotten to experience the realness of these trade wars.
Brian Duncan, he's a hog and a soybean, and you do corn, I guess, too, right?
I do.
Family farm in Northwest Illinois. He's also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, thanks for your time, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
As Ms. Duncan and I were talking about, there are trade talks this week in China. Lots on the table, of course, but don't just pay attention to what they are talking about. Look at who's doing the talking as well. That can tell you how close a deal might or might not be. Who's who around the table? We've got the analysis at marketplace.org. Also, more shutdown news on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow. Food stamps, specifically. What are the workarounds if the supplemental nutrition program runs out of money? On Wall Street today, up, but in a much calmer way than we have become used to. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever fruit those U.S.-China trade talks do bear, one area that's not likely to produce any compromise is the security of American telecommunications networks. U.S. intelligence agencies have suspected the Chinese of hacking and economic espionage for years now. So now the Federal Communications Commission shut down, by the way, over the wall. Anyway, the FCC is considering a ban on telecommunications equipment made by Chinese companies, including the ones you've heard of, ZTE and Huawei by name. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, outside of Washington, D.C., in small markets in rural America, well, that whole story is a whole nother issue.
Just off County Road 32 in Arlington, Alabama, population 456, lives John Nettles. He's a telecom exec, right now trekking through the woods on his family property.
What they call a wait-a-minute vine.
Nettles runs Pine Belt Communications, a tiny phone company his dad built in 1948. The company brought the first cell signals to these parts, a service that saved his friend's life.
This individual was turkey hunting. He got bit by a rattlesnake. He had his phone, and he was able to get help to get to the hospital to save his life.
4 years ago, Pine Belt upgraded to what's called fourth-generation wireless. 4G is what most of the country has. It's mobile broadband. It lets hunters and others watch YouTube and college football, as this is Alabama. Nettles bought 4G servers and hardware from the Chinese company ZTE. It outbid the competition by 45%.
I guess you could say they bought their way into the market.
ZTE machines beam signals from more than 60 cell towers across five counties, all the way back to here, the network nerve center with loads more ZTE machines. He says the Chinese gear has worked pretty well.
Every now and then we run into some language barriers. I don't speak Chinese. They don't speak South Alabama that well. But by and large, it's been a good relationship.
Washington may end it, though. Federal regulators are mulling a ban on telecom gear deemed risky to national security, which to the industry means equipment from Chinese brands ZTE and Huawei. Now, Huawei claims that Washington has never proven Chinese cyber shenanigans. But to many intelligence pros, you don't need a smoking gun. They say Chinese telecom firms are beholden to their government, and they know how to disrupt. Virginia Tech engineering professor Charles Clancy once worked at the National Security Agency.
Huawei, ZTE, or other Chinese companies, they could introduce a software update that would add malicious functionality to the device.
Clancy says the threat isn't to just people's data, like credit card numbers. It also exposes to hackers machines that will talk to one another in a future fifth generation or 5G world. Think robots in a factory or driverless vehicles with sensitive payloads.
One of the major applications of autonomous vehicles is long-haul trucking. So if you have the ability to track that, there's intelligence value that could be had there.
It's not just Washington that's nervous about hacking and tracking. Bans on Chinese telecom equipment are also taking shape in parts of Asia and Europe. But networks without ZTE and Huawei might not perform as well, says China cyber scholar James Mulvenin at the national security contractor SOS International.
Huawei is currently the only global company that makes the entire end-to-end supply chain of 5G equipment. So one of the technology trade-offs is you're not getting access to some of the most advanced 5G equipment in the world.
And back in Alabama, a ban would take away the most affordable infrastructure. Telecom boss John Nettles says if he's forced to replace his Chinese equipment, it would cost millions, and it would delay any upgrades.
So it kind of puts you behind. You know, it's like getting penalized on the kickoff.
And if he doesn't build 5G here, he says the national carriers won't come to this little place. And here, being low-tech drives away the best homegrown talent for the big cities. Jackie Smith owns a coffee shop in nearby Selma.
Getting these younger generations back to Selma, that's going to be our saving grace. But, you know, without technology, they're not coming. They're not coming.
She jokes the only things to spy on here are cows and maybe cotton fields. If Chinese technology can help build a 5G wireless future here, that's a risk she's willing to take. In southern Alabama, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Here in California, there is a new governor as of today. The legislature is back in session, and probably sooner rather than later, they're going to get sucked into a big, messy problem. What to do about the troubled utility PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric? The investor-owned company provides gas and electricity to more than 5 million Californians, and it is widely reported that PG&E is considering bankruptcy as a way to manage what could be billions of dollars in liabilities from the recent wildfires out here. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
The company's equipment was found to have caused or contributed to more than a dozen of the biggest fires in 2017, and investigators are looking into whether PG&E is responsible for starting a fire last November that killed 86 people. PG&E's liability is likely in the tens of billions, so it's reportedly looking into bankruptcy. Travis Miller is an equity analyst at Morningstar.
Bankruptcy could force the hands of regulators to restructure customer rates.
That's because California law requires the utility to be solvent.
Ratepayers pay for it, and they pay for it either through their electric bill or through their tax bill.
Through their tax bill in the form of a bailout from the state legislature, or
the government could simply take it over.
But something's got to happen soon, and PG&E knows it. Clayton Allen is with Height Capital Markets. He says it's no coincidence we're hearing murmurs about a possible bankruptcy right now.
You have the new governor taking office today. You have the legislature being sworn in. And both of those things are something that PG&E wants to kind of pressure.
A California lawmaker is expected to introduce a bill this month to help PG&E absorb potential liabilities. But Allen says that bill might have trouble getting broad support.
I don't think that anyone is really going to be chomping at the bit to support legislation which theoretically makes utilities less vulnerable to liabilities that they potentially are responsible for.
PG&E declined to talk about its plans for this story. In Los Angeles, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Emergency room prices are high, even for things you could buy in a pharmacy.
The only way to find out how high, though, is to get the bill. First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 98 points today, 0.4%, closed at 23,531. The NASDAQ, 84 points to the upside, 1.25%, 6823. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, about 0.7%. 25 and 49. As we mentioned, PG&E reportedly weighing bankruptcy. PG&E disconnected 22% today. Other publicly traded utilities: American Electric Power off about 0.5%. Duke Energy powered down 0.4% today. The pharma giant Eli Lilly announced an $8 billion agreement to buy the cancer drug maker Loxo. Eli Lilly popped up 0.5%. Loxo Oncology boosted more than 66%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.69%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of high school seniors out there are in that limbo between having wrapped up their college applications in the beginning of April or so, and they'll hear one way or the other. For some students this year, though, there is an extra layer of complexity to deal with amid an ongoing lawsuit against Harvard University that claims the school's admissions policies unfairly discriminate against Asian Americans. Marketplace's Justin Ho sat down with some high school seniors in New York City to hear what their application process was like in this current moment.
Bard High School Early College in Queens, New York, is a public high school for high-achieving students in their third and fourth years. Students Zoe Donovan, Rochelle Monto, and Jada Maharjan worked on their college applications while admissions policies involving race were making national news.
Affirmative action is always on a lot of people's minds, I think.
There's this notion that once you're like a black female interested in STEM, you won't be discriminated because it's such a small percentage.
It's helping the few, but it's also excluding the others that are equally as qualified that should get it, but they aren't because colleges just need this certain amount.
Maharjan, that last voice you heard, is South Asian. She decided to just stop worrying about how race might affect her application.
It's not something that I am terrified about because it's going to happen regardless, and it's something I knew that was happening already.
That idea, that schools like Harvard might be limiting the number of Asian students they let in, it's created a niche industry. Companies like Top Tier Admissions and Asian Advantage College Consulting say they can help Asian and Asian American students remove stereotypes from their applications to break through and appear distinctive. Sophia Baluyet, who's mixed-race Asian American, says she worries that trying to avoid stereotypes is the wrong way to fight discrimination.
That sounds like it's trying to say to kids, don't be too Asian, which is kind of just leading to more suppression and more discrimination.
And the question of how to bring up race in a college application had Hannah Oscar, who's African-American, wondering whether she should include it at all.
And like way earlier in the college process,
I heard a lot of people saying, like, of course you're going to get in because of, like, how you identify as African-American. And even in that time, I felt like I needed to prove myself in other ways and say I could get into college without having to identify myself as African-American.
And that dilemma can also add to the pressures all students face to enroll in SAT classes, get essay advice, meet with as many admissions officers as possible. Bishoy Yakub is a North African student.
This is a business. People are making bank over this, over my stress.
This whole process is about branding yourself. The whole process of, like, applying is really just to make yourself look your best and look the most unique.
Zoe Donovan again. She's biracial, half white, half black. She says she struggled with finding ways to look unique on her college applications when everyone else is trying to be unique at the same time.
As, like, a mixed race person, I was like, oh, I'm going to be another mixed race person who writes an essay about being mixed race. But I did it anyway. And yeah, so I think that's definitely on a lot of people's minds, especially people of color, because we're all fighting against stereotypes constantly.
In Bard's class of 2016, 91% of students enrolled in college within 18 months of graduation. When it comes to selecting a school, Jada Maharjan says a recent trip to a small private school upstate got her thinking about how race factors into the college experience.
When I was there, I saw, like, two black faces, I think one Asian, but it just didn't feel like some place that I could express myself the way I wanted. And because of that, I decided that I wouldn't apply.
Sophia Baluyet says when it comes to her college selection, the diversity of the college itself will be a big part of her admission decision.
Although all of the colleges I'm applying to, because most are primarily white institutions, I've still looked for a certain level of diversity in terms of race, because I hope that that would bring diversity of experience, diversity of thought.
That means focusing on a variety of schools instead of the Ivy Leagues. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On the list of experiences none of us want, but which most of us will inevitably have, a trip to the emergency room is right up there. But along with a visit to the ER will inevitably come an emergency room bill. Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy over at Vox, had a story she tweeted out not too long ago about her deep dive into ER billing.
Tweet one. I read a lot of emergency room bills. I read 1,182 of them, to be exact. I read bills from all 50 states. I read bills from patients who were babies and patients who were elderly. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I learned. Tweet 2. People go to the emergency room for so many reasons. I read bills from people who were in a car accident, who thought they had appendicitis, whose kids ate a quarter, or who they themselves ate a big bag of chocolate, only to later realize it was edible marijuana. Tweet 3. Most people are really happy with the care they receive. The marijuana patient, the kid who ate the quarter, they were both treated quickly and well. But a lot of them are overwhelmed and underprepared for the bill they eventually receive. Tweet 4. Emergency room prices are high, even for things you could buy in a pharmacy. I read at least 5 bills where a pregnancy test cost more than $100. That is 20 times the cost of a very nice first response test on Amazon. Tweet 5. The costs are high and they vary hugely from hospital to hospital. For example, I found one hospital charging a single dollar for a squirt of an antibiotic ointment called bacitracin and another hospital charging $76. Tweet 6. Since the prices aren't public, it's impossible for patients to know if they're at the hospital that charges $1 for the ointment or if they're at the hospital that charges 76 times more. Tweet 7. I learned that patients can be billed for just sitting in a waiting room. In one case, more than $5,000. I learned that even at in-network hospitals, patients can face high bills from out-of-network doctors who are working there. Tweet 8. I learned that it feels really vulnerable and confusing to be an ER patient. I had to go to the emergency room over the summer. And even though I write about ER bills for a living, I had no idea how to avoid a surprise one for myself. Tweet 9. The question I get the most is, how do I get my ER bill lowered?
And this is the really frustrating thing. I haven't learned much about that. It's really up to the hospital whether they want to negotiate or not.
Sarah Cliff from Vox. You can follow her on Twitter at Sarah Cliff, where you will get today kind of an amazing story about Zuckerberg, San Francisco General Hospital. Yes, that Zuckerberg. And oh, by the way, if you have seen a Twitter thread you think we would be interested in, pass it along. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. The show is at Marketplace. This final note on the way out today, about which I invite your input, MasterCard put out a press release today, the headline and subhead of which reads as follows: MasterCard evolves its brand mark by dropping its name. Digital payment company adapts to a digital environment in a move to become a symbol brand. I have so very many questions. First of all, what is a symbol brand? And number two, what are we supposed to call it now? Orange and red overlapping ball company? From Kimberly Adams just now on our Slack channel. How about the company formerly known as MasterCard? How about that? Think about it, Prince? Symbol brand? All right, we got to go. Dow up 98 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ found 84 points, 1.25%. S&P 500, 17 points higher, 0.7%. Our daily production team is Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.